kollektivt stasi for Bjørn Lita på Seba Campus. Og lom sen kunne et nista si Boston stasi gitt lill Alexa Andrejevic. Liua persona li sirtna f'madwar 6-7 snin ilu, għedna rekordjaw fl-2024, meta kien għadu Zazu, għadu teenager kważi, u konna reċtajna flimkien freċta mużikali li tellat l-MFCC, u sirna ħbib, umbat permezz tal-Facebook zammejt kuntat miegħu u rajt li qed jagħmel bosta studji. Fil-qasam, wieħed mill-loqsma favoriti tiegħi l-istorja u l-elementi tal-ġrajiet kurrenti, l-istorja internazzjonali, l-ġrajiet internazzjonali, u qed jagħmel dawn l-istudji f'universitajiet magħrufa fir-Renju Unit. U issa li kien hawnhekk hawn Malta fi żmien il-Milied għal vaganzi, deċidejt li nistiednu fl-istudio biex jgħidilna ftit dwar l-istudji tiegħu u l-esperjenzi tiegħu għaliex naħseb ħassibuhom ferm u ferm interessanti. Ħanaqleb l-Ingliż għaliex Alexa huwa Alexa, you are half Maltese, half Serbian.
Of course, yes.
And you speak some Maltese, but you feel more comfortable expressing yourself in English, particularly about your studies.
Yes, yes. I can speak a bit of Maltese, but I think maybe too nervous to keep it on recording for the public.
No worries. So, and in any case, all your studies and all your technical jargon is in English, obviously,
yes,
from
course.
Your books and your lectures. So we'll be able to expound on that in English, and our listeners will have no problem, I'm sure. So welcome to the show, Alexa.
Thank you very much for having me, Colin. It's a pleasure to meet you again after 7 years.
Indeed.
We had performed in Phantom.
Phantom of the Opera, that's right. That was a great experience. But here you are in your mid-20s now, I think.
22.
Oh, so, early 20s.
So, quite young.
Yeah, we had met when you were a teenager. And you're here on holiday from your studies at King's College London at the moment?
Yes. I'm in a gap month period mm-hmm. between the masters, which I have just completed, and mm-hmm. now I've just been accepted to begin my PhD research.
Now, the masters had struck me when I saw you talking about it on Facebook. I'm sure our listeners will be interested when you tell them that your masters, the title of your masters was...
Yes, so I have it to make sure I don't botch it on recording.
That's why I'm
Sure. It was entitled Peerages, Aristocracy, and the Evolution of British Imperial Strategy within Early British Malta, 1800 to 1836. I have a long subtitle, obviously, after that, which was A Study on the Influence of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, and the development of aristocratic diplomacy in the age of British oligarchy and Maltese liberalism.
Wow.
Very bombastic, but as a drama student, you have to...
But also you need to impress, I think you're studying among some of the finest minds possibly in the world. King's College London is internationally renowned. Obviously, we're broadcasting here at the University of Malta, which has a good name around the world, but it's in a small country, it's a small university. We're talking King's College London is level of, Cambridge, Oxford, and the American universities, correct?
I love King's College very much, but they're part of the Russell Group universities in the United Kingdom. So that means that they are in, give or take the top 30 in the country. I think Oxford and Cambridge are, I usually make the gap, Oxford and Cambridge are one step ahead of the London universities. They are, I think when you see the rankings, they tend to come much higher.
Okay.
King's College, if I'm not mistaken, I think globally or in the United Kingdom is ranked in the top 20s, I think, top 20s, around there. But yes, I would say then.
I'm sure you have hundreds of international students who are studying there from around the world.
I mean, unfortunately.
As your colleagues.
Yes, I mean, we have mostly, if I'm not mistaken, they are mostly from China, the United States, and from Southeast Asia, most of the international students. Unfortunately for Europeans, it has, since Brexit, there has been a decline. I feel like I'm the last surviving European breed since Brexit. Obviously, I went to the UK before Brexit happened, so if I left Malta when Brexit had happened, and I have to get a visa and pay the international fees, I would not be there at all.
Okay, but
you know, so most Europeans, yes, that's why they've gone down, because the international fees are just completely, you know,
very expensive.
Very expensive. We don't have home fees anymore.
Yes, but you do pay to study there.
Of course, yes.
You do, but it was a smaller amount.
Yes, it was the home fee, the UK fees, which UK fee. Students pay.
Ah, EU membership. And things didn't change when Brexit happened, because you had been there before Brexit.
Because I've been there, I got the settlement scheme.
Yes.
And
it didn't change.
To be honest, it saved me. I mean, I would not be, like I said, I would never be in the UK at all.
Any other Maltese along your journey in the UK studying?
My professor has mentioned, like I thought when I would go to the UK, I'd be so special. Like, I'd be like, I'm from Malta, you know, and it's so, no, they're like, oh, we've seen everyone under the sun. Okay, Malta, we've had, like, and they start counting on their fingers. But I have never encountered another Maltese student. But that's not, I mean, I guess that's just unique to me. I know, like, other people who are there who met someone in the university.
Yes.
Me, myself, I have not.
In your field as well, they might be doing medicine or other things.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there are students around. I just have not, I guess, encountered them. Maybe I'm a bit of a loner, I don't know.
Alexa Andreevich, let's go back to your childhood and your journey to how you got where you are now. So you're half Serbian.
Yes.
But you've lived most of your life before you went to the UK in Malta.
Most of my life in Malta, yes. I've never lived in Serbia.
Mm-hmm. And your education was at...
So my education here in Malta was... I mean, if anyone cares about primary school, it was at Chiswick. And then I went to St. Martin's College.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the sixth form at that school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that's basically the education in Malta.
So by the time, yes, you got to 18...
I left.
And what made you decide to follow... What was your undergraduate degree?
So my undergraduate degree was in history and international relations. When I was 18, I was very interested in trying to... As your basis, your undergraduate degree, I wanted it to be something which connected not only the past, but it tried to integrate history with, contemporary politics of today. Back then, I think I was reading the works of the historian R.G. Collingwood. I think the Maltese historians here obviously would know R.G. Collingwood, a very well-known historian who wrote The Idea of History. And he really talked about the importance of history. It's not really just, studying the past because it's just interesting. You know, I like this period because it's just fascinating to know.
Yeah.
But the importance of it is that you study the past in order to understand what man has done and thus what man is, which is a big quote and a very famous quote from the book. So I really wanted to try and integrate history to contemporary policy of today's world. But when I started the course, I realized how hard that actually is to put into practice. It's a very tough, very tough business to try and merge the two together and not get, you know, butchered by your professors instantly when you start discussing these.
Indeed. Now, how far was your decision to study history and international relations influenced by the fact that you lived and were brought up in a country surrounded by historic monuments, historic buildings, ancient battles, etc.? And also from your father's side, Serbian, coming from the Balkans, which has seen its fair share of issues, still does, and fairly recently as well, a civil war. But how far did these influences play a part in your decisions?
Okay, so just for the record, because people might, you know, Malta's very small, they might know my father. Obviously, he came for love. So okay. He came for my mother. So it had nothing to do with contemporary affairs. Most of my research thus far hasn't been on the Balkans. I think mostly because the truth is, you know, my father is Serbian, and he obviously was born in Serbia, has a different experience of the world and living in that country than I do. Why? Because I've never lived there, but I've lived here. I've lived in Malta, and I thus know the story of I studied Maltese history. I'm quite aware of the history of my family here under the British and at least the end of the Order of St. John. And I think probably the history of my own personal family was very influential to guiding me to, I guess, starting off my career in, when I say starting off, in my master's at least thesis, starting off my career in focusing on the British Empire and focusing on the Maltese islands. Because when we studied Maltese history here, and so this is, I'm talking about now secondary school and sixth form, so I'm not talking about the university. I haven't been here, so I'm not going to, you know, talk about the courses and how they're taught here, because I have not experienced it. But for secondary school and sixth form, we studied Maltese history, particularly we had a very post-colonial approach to studying history. And that, what do I mean by that? Post-colonial historiography. Usually, the premise of the research on Maltese history is based on the idea that the British Empire, obviously, they've written a lot about the empire itself and how the British people forged Malta, but post-colonial history argues that we need to talk more about the Maltese people themselves and the people who are lost to history, how the Maltese are the main catalyst to changing the course of Maltese history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I
does that also apply to the time of the Knights of St. John, for example? We always hear about La Valette and this knight and that knight and the Great Siege, but
that gets more complicated, because I think here in Malta, the Knights of St. John, sometimes we tend to perceive it as nearly a connection to our Maltese identity, which is quite fascinating, because, you know, people, when they talk about the British, it's usually a story of you know, the you know, suppression. They are foreign people in our native soil, and it's a story of how we resisted to create the Maltese nation state that we have here today. It's a very post-colonial approach, and obviously that's incredibly important and correct to study this this way of looking at Maltese history, especially under the British. But I found it very confusing, because if I think about my great grandfather, whose name was Captain Peter Paul Shikluna, he was a Labour politician in the government of in the Parliament of 1945 of Sir Paul Boffa.
Wow.
But he was a socialist, yet also an imperialist. He was someone was very much, he thought that a Maltese identity was interlinked with being British. So his passport, which was a British passport, he envisioned, not like these days, the British people in the UK tend to think being British, you know, Brexit, it's about the UK, being British is English, Scottish, and that's it. But actually, originally, being British was supposed to be this like term to bind different imperial subjects under a mission.
Indeed.
And so I found that very confusing, because my great-grandfather, Maltese, no British connections at all, was someone who, you know, really looked up to the British Empire, and he thought he was part of an imperial mission. And so I was curious in saying, how can we connect the story of struggle in Malta to the the personal connections that different Maltese people might have had with the British Empire? It wasn't the case, like post-colonial history, we tend to say all of Malta was for 164 years suppressed by the British, and all of us, we did nothing up until the end where we gained independence. You know, we were struggling only, always struggling.
Apart from the occasional flare-up. Oh, yeah, like
the flare-up where we got our constitutions, and it was because we were all fighting. But in reality, for an empire, for a colony to stay secure for that long, needs to have at least the blessing of not the majority, but the influential at the time, the influential members of the island itself.
Therefore,
you think of the church, you think of certain members of the Maltese nobility. And, you know, if you make an example, let's think of other British interventions in the Mediterranean. You think of Sicily, where the British at the time they had intervened under Sir William Bentinck. Who's, if you would know, I mean, I'm sure the listeners would know, was a governor of Bengal and then governor of India in the 1830s. He had intervened in Sicily, and it was a failed process. They had left in 1811. In Corsica, there was the British had taken Corsica for, I think, a handful of years. I still have to go into detail about it. But again, there was a revolt, and the British had to leave there. So the roots of Malta, kind of the roots of an empire, are built around the people and how they react to the empire being in their territory.
And you found this very fascinating.
Yes, this moves to the masters, the masters came from this idea which I had. And that's why I wanted to write about the Order of Saint Michael and Saint George. Now, what is that? I think a lot of... I mean, again, the Maltese history professors here and lecturers obviously know about the peerage which was created in Malta. This was a British peerage that was created in 1818, and it was dedicated for Maltese subjects of noble birth and the people of the Ionian Islands, noble birth as well, and any British general or governor who served for these two islands. So I said, okay, so what is the purpose of creating a peerage, which is not, they didn't do it for every colony, you know, create a random peerage. They used to do peerages a lot for India.
Yeah.
The Star of India is one of the famous examples. But the Order of Calvary, which was a peerage which was dedicated to... European nobilities. Monarchs of Europe. Okay. So British monarchs and all the monarchs of Europe, wherever they fall, it was a peerage to bind them together. So the Order of St. Michael and St. George was, I would say, if I'm not mistaken, at least one of the first peerages to be created for colonial subjects in order to try and give them the illusion of being equal to the British nobility and the British aristocracy. So the masters, that means the masters, is dedicated to trying to see how in the early 19th century the Maltese nobility lost a lot of influence since the uprising of 1789. They lost a lot of
influence.
Of 17, sorry, thank you. Sorry, that's French Revolution. Yes, sorry, my bad.
You must
right.
have so many dates in your mind doing a PhD.
Yes, no, no, 1798. No.
Absolutely. I mean, we're told or we read that like the Maltese expected the British to sort of respect the fact that they had risen up against the French and sort of won our freedom. So we want you to come here and protect us, but we also want to run our own affairs. Yes. And they ignored that eventually,
yes,
didn't they?
Of course they did, yes. And they... And that, so from, we would say, from 1800 till 1813, there was this big debate of how much will the nobility of Malta take part in governing Malta. Now, there are a lot of, and what we see with the Order of St. Michael and St. George is that they lose the power by 1813 with Sir Hildebrand Oakes and the first royal constitution that is created.
Who was governor?
Yes, he was the civil commissioner.
Civil
at the
commissioner.
Time. And William Accord. William Accord was another person who was helping in the process.
I'll just stop you for a second for the benefit of listeners who maybe know a little bit about Maltese history, but not exactly what happened when.
Yeah.
It was 1814 that there was the treaty that finally solidified.
Treaty of Paris gave Malta.
Malta to the Brits. Because there was still doubt, like for the first, yes, between 1800 and 1813, 1814.
The British weren't really sure of what Malta was going to be. If
and neither were the
back.
Maltese. And I mean, there was talk of going back to the Knights of St. John.
Either going with Sicily again.
The Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, Naples, etc.
The Spanish, I found out from Adam Zamoyski, another historian who wrote about the Congress of Vienna. He had said even the Spanish were at a point saying, okay, if the knights want to come back to the Mediterranean, we can give them an island. I forgot which island, and we will then maybe annex Malta itself. Wow. It was something light; it didn't go into anywhere. But it shows that people really wanted to get the island.
And
who's going to take the island?
And the Knights of St. John at the time, their grandmaster was Russian, right? The Russian Tsar.
So the first,
you know, Russia was eyeing the Mediterranean and maybe a base here. Possibly.
I would say by 1814, though. Paul the First, who was the Grand Master, he had already died. Okay. And I think Alexander the First was already like here. He was already moving away
from the idea.
But
so the Brits eventually decided, or the Treaty of Paris, it was decided that the Brits are going to stay here.
And the Maltese nobility will, and this was the important thing, that the Maltese nobility will, they will lose their militia, which they had created in the siege of 1798. Will be removed, and instead we will have a governor with Sir Thomas Maitland, a very autocratic type of governor, who will take hold of the island, and the nobility will not take part in, you know, at least
not a direct part.
Why? Because the British were very worried. They said that they have a militia. We remember what happened in like I mentioned, Corsica and other islands. They can easily rise up again against us. We're better off trying to remove them, removing their actual power, I call it, my master. So their actual power of having actual influence in the island is reduced. But with the order of St. Michael and St. George, they give the Maltese nobility the illusion of power.
I think that is one of the
main reasons why there's such a gap between 1813 and the next big, Maltese like protest revolt in 1830, when we start getting the 1831 petition, where we get Giorgio Mitrovic and all these figures. There's such a gap. There's a silence in that period, a silent period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one aspect of that silence was that this peerage was given to a handful of Maltese judges, noblemen, to try and give them the satisfaction of at least having a presence in the British system. They would be invited to the governor balls. They would eat with the governor and meet British administrators. They weren't separate. It wasn't like a
almost
segregated.
Like
they were mixing with them. They were dining with them.
So, almost like breads and circuses. We're giving them the illusion of, you can participate with us.
You don't
have any real power, but
they became very similar, I guess, to I would say like the Maharajas and Nawabs of India, their presence was so important that there was a performance to the Maltese nobility.
Yeah.
Was it a success? From 1818 to 1830, it's not a long period, to be honest. So it eventually, I think, the rise of Maltese liberalism and the rise of the liberal revolutions in Europe in 1830 played its role in saying, listen, we don't really want peerages anymore. We nobles, we're not focused on our status as much anymore. We're focused on the nation. And that's a difference in mentality. Because the nobles, if you think of the nobles under the Knights of St. John, late 18th century and early 19th century, the first generation of Maltese nobles, I think when I see them, they were much more, I guess, interested in a lot of their titles, their personal
their
presence,
family,
their regal titles. It was before the nation itself became something really, a really formulated system.
That's a 19th century phenomenon, isn't it?
Some people, I mean, look, that is an idea. I think maybe other people will say, actually, no, it's not true. Maybe, no, by 1800, already the nation state, because you think about the Declaration of Rights for the Maltese people, the Declaration of the inhabitants of Malta and Gozo. It came in 1801.
Uh-huh.
But it suddenly, after they wrote it, it flopped. It disappeared from the public eye, and even the nobles stopped talking about it by 1830. I mean, there's such a big gap. Mm. There's a big question mark on why they were so quiet.
I'm talking to Alexa Andreevich, who is talking about his dissertation for his master's, Master of Arts in World History and Cultures. It was called, I have it in my hands here, it's nicely bound, it's very beautiful, Peerages, Aristocracy and the Evolution of British Imperial Strategy Within Early British Malta, a study on the influence of the Order of St. Michael and St. George and the development of aristocratic diplomacy in the age of British oligarchy and Maltese liberalism, 1800 to 1836. Now, I know a lot of our listeners here on Campus 103.7 are interested in history, particularly Maltese history, so I hope you're finding this program interesting. Alexa is studying now for his PhD at King's College London, which is where you did this master's. What's the PhD going to focus on?
So I haven't even begun the PhD, but I have a little title, which will obviously be changed. But it's I guess it's a good idea to. It's just as long.
Okay. But listen, before you tell us,
no worries.
We focus on the PhD. I wanted to ask you whether our listeners could get their hands on your master's dissertation and read it. Is it possible to be read? Is it maybe online somehow, or is it going to be in some library somewhere?
I think in the future, when I begin the PhD, because I was speaking to my professors at King's about this, I decided that it's better that I begin my PhD, and the more I grow, because I'm still quite young to publish, I think. I mean, I will have to grow a bit more in how I research, and I will go back to the thesis and develop it to publish it, maybe as a journal article, because it's important to say to the Maltese, our Maltese listeners, that it's not like in the University of Malta. A master's thesis is not 30,000 words. It's not massive. It's only 15,000.
I see.
It's supposed to be it's supposed to teach the student, a master's student, how to write a journal article for an academic paper.
Ah.
You know, it's supposed to be the master's, which I've written, would be one chapter of a PhD, and a PhD has 7 chapters.
Ah.
So
okay.
It
does look fairly thin, to be honest.
Yes, I was thinking. It's quite thin.
Plus, it's got some pictures which you've made sure to. But it went down well, and did you?
Yes, it got an A.
An A.
So it was a yeah. It was
and
a success.
You had to do research both here in Malta and in
Kew Gardens,
isn't it? That's where
the National Archives.
The National Archives are in the UK, so that must have been interesting.
Yeah.
And did you have to defend it? Is that what they call it?
You defend for the PhD.
Okay.
I'd be very terrified of our defense.
But you were mentioning earlier on how some people think this about history and some people argue this. Do you have debates and at King's College about even your own
what you
focus on, and you have to. So you have arguments.
I think my
good-natured ones, of course.
Yes,
hopefully.
I think the beauty of university is that it's the field where you learn from your professors, you learn from your lecturers, but you truly learn from your fellow students. I mean, that's the beauty. I mean, I think some students I've met there I know are going to be some of the greatest historians in the UK, because. You know, me, I would say, I have this idea about something. And they're like, so it is wrong because of A, B, C, D, E, F, G, X, Y, Z. And I'd be like...
These are your contemporaries.
Fellow students. And we have great debates. And you always learn from each other. And everyone is so different. Everyone has so many different things they want to discuss. Some of them much broader than mine. I said I'd rather start with something very precise in a very precise period, on a very specific period, and talk about this. Others have gone for studying the British Empire, British Empire colonial policy in the Caribbean, trying to compare it, you know, to later policies which were done in the 19th century. So there are people who are trying to measure early 19th century, or rather 18th century, you know, British foreign policy, mm-hmm. trying to see whether there are lessons that the British learned from those policymakers to, you know, the late 19th century. I mean, those are like humongous intellectual journeys, which, you know, I'm not yet ready to embark on.
Yeah, as we said in the beginning of the show, you're only 22. I think you've done a lot so far.
I thus far, everything I've said, I have to just say, like, in truth, I mean, I'm very talkative, but I know nothing. We will all. The best people are the ones who recognize that. And
keep learning and keep learning.
Yes,
indeed.
Yes.
Alexa, let's take a musical break. And I thought it would be nice to hear some music from maybe your Serbian half, the Serbian half of your heritage. Your father is originally from Serbia. So perhaps a song maybe from your childhood. Or have you visited Serbia a number of times, I assume?
I have family there, so I always love going to Serbia to visit my ethnic roots.
Indeed, indeed. It sounds like an interesting country. Perhaps a song from your Serbian heritage?
Yes, I do. I have a song which as a child, I remember my father and a lot of his generation. My father was born in the 1960s, so he's of an old generation, I guess, of Serbian peoples. And his song, he loves a lot of love songs, classic songs.
Yes.
And we have one song by, again, I don't speak Serbian. This is me listening. So it's called Milijaka. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry for all my Serbian friends if I butchered that.
Yes.
But it's a very famous song. I advise anyone to get their Shazam and turn it on the radio and keep it on their Spotify list.
The artist? Who's the artist?
The artist is Halid Bezlic. Bezlic? Butchered it. But you can listen to it, find it on Shazam, and you can listen to it and find more details.
Da vidim tvoj dragi lik Ja sve ove dane Tješim ja rane A bolan više sam od njih Jednom si rekla Nisi porekla Da sam za tebe jedini Mene si zvala A srce dala Drugome da ga isprosi Ko bi rekao čuda da se dese, pa Miljacka mostove odnese, da ne mogu tebi doć, da ne mogu ulicom ti proć. Ko bi rekao čuda da se dese, pa Miljacka mostove odnese, Čekam kad ćeš doći u život moj Ja sve ove noći živim u samoći Jer mogu biti samo tvoj Jednom si rekla, nisi porekla Da sam za tebe jedini Mene si zvala,
srce dala drugome da ga isprosi. Ko bi rekao čuda da se dese, pa Miljacka mostove odnese, da ne mogu tebi doć, da ne mogu ulicom ti proć. Ko bi rekao čuda da se dese, pa Miljacka mostove odnese, da ne mogu tebi doć, da ne mogu ulicom ti proć.
Well, music from Serbia there, Aleksa Andrević, who is my guest today, that was chosen by him. He's half Maltese, half Serbian. It would be interesting, perhaps, in your future, once you've graduated, done your PhD, and when you're working on future projects, to look into the relationship between Malta and Serbia, particularly when Serbia was part of Yugoslavia. Because the relationship between the two countries is quite old. Our leader Mintov was friends with the famous leader Tito in Yugoslavia. In the time when Yugoslavia had the communist rule, but there were Yugoslav tourists would often come to Malta and vice versa. This is in a time when perhaps travel was a little bit restricted. So I think the relationship between the two countries goes back quite a long way. It might be interesting for someone to do an academic study about it, if it doesn't already exist.
You sound just like my father. I mean, I'm sure they love that.
Indeed. But we were going to talk about your PhD and your tentative title for it, which perhaps we can hear now.
Of course. So the PhD title, it's obviously, this is, I haven't even commenced. I got my offer just the beginning of this month in December. It's obviously very, it's going to change. But this is the broad idea. The title is Imperial Antiquity and Ornamentalism in the British Mediterranean, 1750 to 1848. And this is the subtitle, which helps to explain that title. A study on how the British aristocracy envisioned Southern Europe and its historical implications to the British imperial imagination, 1750 to 1848. Now, that can change in like a heartbeat when my professor hears it, Professor John Wilson. But the idea of the PhD is I would like to study the British in the Mediterranean, but not really in the way that I guess usually British historians on the British Empire, they tend to talk about the British in the Mediterranean as mostly a history of the navy, of imperial
terms.
Strategy, military, yeah. the Napoleonic War, Nelson, exactly. I would like to connect that military history with the personal, with the how the British travelers, aristocratic travelers, how did their travels, their experiences of traveling to to Southern Europe, to Italy,
the famous Grand Tour.
The famous Grand Tour. Yes, well done. Yes, that's going to be a very important feature. I have a book here which I got for my on Christmas Day, my great Christmas gift on Byron and translation, the study of Byron and how he used to write a lot of translations of ancient scripts of ancient Greece.
There's
and
even streets named after him in Malta.
He
visit here.
The important theme is trying to integrate the personal experiences of the British and how does Southern Europe influence the way that the British see themselves in the world. So it's a journey in the discovery of a British identity in a time, this is early 19th century, in a time when the nation state is being formed, where liberalism is rising, but there's still the traditions of the old aristocracy of the old hierarchies, and we want to try and come to grips with how that journey, how Europe influenced the British vision of the world. Now, I think you've noticed that most of my work is on the British, mostly the British aristocracy I've chosen. Now, the reason to it is, number one, I'm very interested in these figures who, to be honest, ran the British Empire like it was a playground. It was a very oligarch system, very small. Many people were, related to one another.
It was almost a game.
It was like a game of empire. And in this period, there were so many different British imperialists who envisioned the empire so differently. So it's not like when we study the British Empire, we tend to say this is in 1800, this was the view of the British Empire. But if you speak to Byron, or if you speak to Sir Thomas Maitland, or if you speak to Sir William Bentinck, or I'll throw all the different types of British imperialists I can, Sir William Wilberforce, many of these people had very contradictory, or if not contradictory, they had very unique ways of looking at themselves in the world. And so we see that Britishness, I mean, being British and being a British imperialist, is not just one story journey. It's a self-discovery of how, when the British travel to places, the places that they travel to, the buildings that they see, the architecture that they witness, influences the way that they see themselves in the world. That's a very broad idea.
Some of them even go native, don't they?
Yes.
Which is what a phrase that used to be used when eventually people like Lawrence of Arabia, for example, he dressed like the Arabs that he would be trying to influence for. So still trying to propagate the British idea and the British interests, but by doing it by being one of the people who are, under the empire, or that they wish to integrate into the empire.
Yeah, that's a great thing to bring up, because when you mention Lawrence of Arabia, he was inspired by the travelers of the early 19th century. Think of Alexander Burnes, who traveled to Afghanistan in the 1840s. Historians who talk about this are people like William Dalrymple or Maya Jaffanoff of Harvard University. And they talk about how, if you think about the British in India, for example, there are people like, I'm going to mention names, you can look them up, people like Sir David Ochterlony, or Crackpatrick, James Achilles Crackpatrick, which William Dalrymple discusses. And these are British imperialists who, they don't, it's quite a controversial term, gone native. They don't just go native because of, perform for, the British people at home, saying how romantic they are. Like Byron used to perform. He was the absolute snob of Britain, of England, he used to perform in all these clothes of ancient Greece, very romantic. But these people actually, they lived their lives in India and they changed their identity, became mixed naturally. It's actually a very multicultural, story of British imperialists, marrying into converting to Islam. And it's a fascinating time, because that is the period. I'm talking about now 1700s, the 1700s. It's such a fascinating time, because before the nation state and the idea of a hegemonic culture and a minority culture became so predominant, it was a time where it was actually not that, odd to see people go and nearly change their identity, have a mixed identity, because there was no like real details of these borderlands, hinterlands, nation state structured territories. It was very much you can go and make a life for your own in a territory in India.
So all this fascinates you, and you aim to do your PhD. We've spoken a lot about your studies. Where do you see yourself in about, 10 years' time? When, hopefully, you successfully achieve your PhD? And what's your career going to be like? Are you going to be a historian? Will you be will you remain an academic?
I hope I have a job, you know.
Yeah, indeed.
I think any Maltese person who, you know, like if I say like, I like history, I want to study history, they're like, yeah. Okay, how are you gonna make money?
How are you going to survive?
But
perhaps you would enter the diplomatic field.
No. The first objective is to become a lecturer at a university, probably in the United Kingdom, and usually how that works. So if you think about the details of this, what I think, probably lecturers here in the University of Malta can say otherwise if there's another thing I'm not getting. Usually you finish your PhD. When you finish the PhD, you commence to try and create it into a monograph. Monograph is usually, it's actually like this book I have. What? I have a book on Lord Byron here. Mm. It will become your first book, a monograph. You can publish it with, the Royal Historical Society or with other specific academic journals. Usually your professors will advise you on where to take it. And when it's published, there is this gap period between gaining a fellowship to conduct your next research. If the PhD is a success and you are able and you publish it and you're able to get a fellowship with, I mentioned societies like the Royal Historical Society, the Institute for Historical Research, the Royal Asiatic Society. These different groups give fellowships. Fellowships are to give you money to conduct your next research after your PhD.
Yeah.
And when you have that fellowship, it gives you the armor that when you go to apply for a position as a lecturer at a university, which is very competitive, you can say not only that you have a PhD, because everyone has a PhD who go into lecturing, but you have a PhD which has done well, and that you are writing another, you're beginning your next research, and that is backed by a respectable institute.
Yeah, institute.
It shows that people believe in the work that you're doing. Mm. And that gives you the ability at least to reach for the stars of becoming a lecturer.
Yeah.
You might still fail. I might still fail. But I tell anyone, living in Malta, that you're better off giving everything till you reach that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And either reach for that star or you land on a cloud. I mean, if I don't become a lecturer, it won't be the end of the world, because, a PhD means that regardless if you lecture or not, you will be able to write about history.
Indeed, you can publish.
Anyone can write. To be honest, anyone can write about history. It's just that, obviously, a PhD is supposed to be like, it shows that you have been taught in the methods of research. Not that you have been taught how to research. Many people research without a PhD, obviously. But a PhD is there to help to teach you the methods of conducting those research. So you have professors guiding you in the way of how to do a research project.
Of course, it's the most respected. You're bound to respect someone with a PhD a little bit more than someone who doesn't have a PhD when you're reading a historical work.
I think if you like history...
A work of history.
If you can do it. I think if you like history, you should... and you really love it and you have the means to do it, I would say that the best thing you can do is take it to the very end. Take it to the end, to a PhD. So then, for the rest of your life, regardless of what you do, I love book publishing. I could, if I don't become an academic, I'll go into, I don't know, I'll try and go to Penguin or I'll go to Bloomsbury Publishing. Mm. And I help other people publish their works. I'll go to the Liverpool University Press or the Cambridge University Press or another press system.
Yeah.
And I'll help other people publish their works.
Alexa, I'm just going to ask you now about some of the perhaps familiar names or names that would be familiar to us. People like me who are interested in history and have read various history books or popular history books, perhaps not so much academic history books. I didn't actually study history at university, unfortunately, but It's never too late.
Never too late, Colin.
And the University of Malta offers many opportunities even to study on a part-time basis. Perhaps some familiar names that you have encountered, that you have been taught by, that you have debated with along your journey at King's College London.
So if we talk about popular books, I think every student here, or you don't even need to study history, would know of the names of William Dalrymple, Peter Frankopan, Andrew Roberts, Sir Niall Ferguson.
Wow.
These are all figures who...
I watched their YouTube videos interviews with them on YouTube.
Popular historians, they're called.
You've been in the same room with these people.
I've witnessed them. Some of them I spoke to, which was always a... It was like a pinch-me moment. All historians that, you know, if they write on Twitter, you have the entire, you know... Twitter comment section either lambashing them from left and right, depending on who I mentioned, you know, everyone's ripping them to shreds. But when you meet them, they're just, you know, they're normal people. They're professors, and they're professors who have been, you know, I guess they're not all professors. Sorry, I have to correct that. But they are all historians. Mm-hmm. They're people who got the public eye, and I think that's something which we tend to, you know, we get scared about these days. We think that it's scary when people either you're controversial, you have people criticizing you or loving you. The most important thing is that people are listening to you, and these are the people who really make a difference.
Indeed.
And I advise anyone who writes history to, I guess, be brave and try and take risks, you know, when discussing history, you know, try and put yourself out there.
Are there any more names you can mention?
Yes.
While you're preparing your list, my favorite book, I have to say, is by Niall Ferguson, The War of the World, which is a look back at the 20th century and all the different wars that occurred in that century and why they occurred. And it's fascinating. It's amazing, monumental work, in my opinion. And it's I feel like I've almost met the man now by talking to you. That's just incredible.
Yeah, I think the PhD advice I gave to people was the advice that he gave to me when I spoke to him, and I said, you know, what advice would you give a PhD student who wants to, you know, begin a career as a historian? And he said to me, Alexa.
Because he's Scottish, isn't he?
Yes. You don't need to be a professor in history to write history. And the truth is that the historian you can write it with a PhD and you can do any other career. Many historians these days tend to be, you know, you think of Simon Sebag Montefiore, Andrew Roberts, as I mentioned, William Dalrymple. These are people who didn't lecture at the university. They had very different careers. Andrew Roberts was a banker, if I'm not mistaken, and he changed and started writing history books. It's possible to have a career as a historian. We don't go into the university. I guess that made me a bit more calm, but I kind of love the university. You know, I love the actual university.
The life
some historians just hate they don't like lecturing, but they like writing history. Mm. I like lecturing and also writing history. But that was his advice.
So mention some others that you've worked with, and then it's time to conclude the program. And I'm sure you have some advice for perhaps young people who might want to follow in your footsteps, perhaps even study abroad after doing maybe an undergraduate course here at the University of Malta, or spend some time studying abroad. Maybe you'd like to tell us about your experience in brief. But your list of other academics that you've encountered over the years.
So, you know, these people which I mentioned are obviously very popular figures, but I think I want to, give respect to the professors and lecturers along the way in the 5 years I've been abroad who have really helped me as a person, not only as a historian, but as a person and someone who loves to research in general. When I was at, before I went to King's College, I did my bachelor's at Liverpool Hope University. It's a small university in Liverpool, and I was taught by Professor Bryce Evans, who is a well-known UK food historian. recent publication was Feeding the People of Wartime Britain and Ireland During the Second World War. He one of the leading food historians and a field in history that we tend to take for granted. You know, the study of food and rationing during the Second World War. Another one was Professor Stephen Kelly, who was the head of the history department at Liverpool Hope, and he was the professor. He was focused mostly on Irish, modern Irish, and contemporary UK Irish history. He wrote a very well known book on Margaret Thatcher and the Conservative Party in the Northern Ireland conflict, 1975 to 1990. At King's, my PhD advisor now, supervisor, Professor John Wilson, I think the most famous is professor who I think many people would know of. He's well known of writing on India. He wrote The Chaos of Empire, the study of the British Raj in India. And now he's writing a global history on the evolution of the nation state, which is a humongous, I mean, like, massive. I mean, I can't Rick, understand. Yeah. I have no idea how he's doing it. He's a god to promote. And then Dr. Michael Rowe, my last professor I want to thank. He was my master's supervisor, and it was with his teaching. He's a European historian. With his teaching, his advice, his Socratic method of asking questions of my work really helped me, you know, I guess, guide my thoughts through my master's. And he will be my second supervisor, and I look forward to work with him on this great, I guess, this great journey now, which I'm in.
Well, we send our salutations as well to all these professors that you mentioned. What about a word of advice to anybody listening to us, perhaps youngsters? You're 22 years old, people who are deciding what to do with their career, what they want to study.
I think that the Erasmus scheme is very important, but I think I advise everyone to try and go, let it be a year, maybe if you can longer. Spend a good amount of time abroad, if you can, to conduct your research, maybe in your master's or your future PhD. It might be scary. I mean, I left when I was 18, Malta. I left Malta when I was 18. I left with some excitement because I always wanted to go to the UK. And I thought, as a historian, that is the place where I need to go. You need to... whatever field that you want to do in your career, I say to, you know, Maltese students, go to the places where there are the best in your field, if you can, always. Try and find whatever way you can, to see if there are loan schemes. If it's in the EU, check for the, you know, EU loan schemes. If you have an opportunity to go to the UK, if you have maybe citizenship or you can make it to study abroad, try and find any way possible in going to the places where these academic discussions and research are taking place. Because it's the people that you meet which help you the most in developing your career. It's not only the knowledge that you get from these universities, but it's the networking and the relationships you built along the way. And it's so important because Malta is very small. And, you know, you might love Malta to stay here, that's true, but you need to take that stage in your life of being away and discovering another region of the world. Take risks. It might be scary, but you have to do it. It's important. That's obviously my view. I wish you all the best, all of you in the university. This is a new year, and I make sure that 2025 is a year of developing your skills as a researcher, as an academic, or in whatever field you're doing. You know, don't stay safe. Don't stay in a cozy environment.
Words of wisdom there from Alexa Andreevich, who's been my guest here today during this edition of Colin Fitz Asks, or Colin Fitz Discovers, Colin Fitz Finds Out, Colin Fitz Eustace on Campus 103.7. Thank you, Alexa. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much. And everyone, have a happy new year.
And with that, we conclude today's programme.